以下节目内容纯属主持及嘉宾个人意见，与本台立场无关。
自古以来，神秘事物一直都冲击住人类文明每一个角落，解释不到却有似有还无的故事，永远都引人入胜。究竟今日越来越多神秘现象的发生，代表着什么呢？今晚就等我们一起启动神秘学研究档案。Okay guys, welcome to MJ13 and this is your host Chuck Faden here. Today, this is the first time as an English episode. So, we bring in a guest, the name is Neil Glue. Hi Neil.
How are you, Chuck Faden?
Yeah, okay, Neil Glue, Neil is from Exopolitics Hong Kong. Okay, Neil, can you tell me, can you tell the audience, what is Exopolitics?
Exopolitics is the study of the social and political implications of extraterrestrial life engaging this planet. In other words, once we know that and it's confirmed that ETs are real and engaging us, how does that affect the social side, the political side of our society? But exopolitics is also a field of study. So we use this political science to take first-hand witness testimony to investigate ufology, because exopolitics has, we say, subsumed, it's absorbed all the other fields of science, astrobiology, mythology, paleoanthropology. It all comes under this exopolitical umbrella. So from here, we have what we call a multidisciplinary process. In other words, we can use all the different disciplines to study these extraterrestrial cases, rather than just saying, I'm a ufologist. You know, a ufologist goes along, he's more scientific, and he might just look for traces on the ground, or he might, you know, get hold of some evidence. But generally, they ignore witness testimony. You know, they're more interested in what we call empirical evidence.
They ignore the testimony.
You know, a lot of people don't take testimony into account. I mean, the basis of our legal system, you know, in court, it's all about witness testimony. You can put somebody in jail, you can execute somebody in certain countries, even though there's a murder with no body.
Right.
So you can see that this is a tremendous leap forward, exopolitics, in using this concept of first-hand witness testimony to extract the truth. And you'll see your next guest is probably one of the world experts in terms of first-hand witness testimony.
Okay, so this is what the main principle of exopolitics. Whether they believe or they don't believe in some cases, they use this as a base. Is that right?
We use this as the correct, let's say, template or field of study or political science, so that we can, in fact, have a platform to look at all aspects, because you can't look at contact from the point of a ufologist just through, you know, a single telescope. You need to have a very, very wide spectrum of field of vision to study all the aspects of the cases, because extraterrestrials have been visiting us for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. So you can't just look from a ufologist's perspective. You've got to look at the archaeologists, you've got to look at the mythologists, you've got to look at the astrobiologists, you've got to look at the geologists, even the glyphs, paintings on walls, caves, and from there we get a much better basis from which to study this phenomena.
Of course.
Okay, so anyway, this is the first time we broadcast this in English, and I hope this guest we are bringing in the future can tell a little bit more stories, or not really the stories but the cases, to the audience so they knew the aliens does exist when we are not alone. Okay, so now we're gonna bring in Paula Harris today, and she's gonna tell the story. This is gonna be the first time in Hong Kong. I mean, nobody ever heard about it and nobody really talked about it before. Is that right?
Well, yes. I mean, you're dealing with the world's top Italian-American photojournalist. I mean, Paula is an investigative reporter in the field of extraterrestrial-related research. She is the most powerful of all the journalists because Paula doesn't assume anything. She doesn't do internet research. Paula actually goes along, gets on a plane, and goes and visits people and extracts the testimony from the people directly. So Paula will face on,
right?
She will look at what they have, and she's able to feel, you know, when you talk to somebody, you get much better feeling about whether they're telling the truth. You can establish what is their motivation, are they lying, what are the circumstances behind them, what are the backgrounds behind them. And this is what Paula's an expert at, and she's written 3 books, which will be on your website. People will be able to see on your website.
Right.
Where each book in itself is, these are going to be university textbooks one day, because each book is interviews with various leading players in the field of exopolitics.
Right.
And some of these people, many of these people, your audience already knows.
Mm.
So this is very, very important indeed. And in fact, Paula assisted Dr. Alan Hynek with his UFO investigations, and Paula's interviewed many top military witnesses, you know, concerning the UFO truth embargo.
Right.
I mean, the most stunning thing of the whole thing for me, actually, is that Paula met and interviewed Colonel Philip Corso in Roswell.
Right.
And the reality of which is that Paula became a very, very close friend of Philip Corso. So every time I hear people talking about Philip Corso, oh, this is not true, that's not true, all you've got to do is get Paula's book and read it, or all you've got to do is listen to Paula. Mm. And what Paula tells you, you can take it to the bank.
Mm.
So, in fact, she was also a very close friend, because you've heard of all the business about the Vatican, you know, helping release information, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
Paula's a close friend of Monsignor Padre Corrado Balducci.
Mm.
Fortunately, he's just passed away last year.
Right.
But basically, she assisted in filming the Italian witnesses, including Balducci, for Dr. Stephen Greer's Disclosure Project in 2001. Now, what do you think about that?
Mm.
So, you know, we're dealing with somebody who knows them all. You know, whether it's John Mack, which you've heard us talk about a lot, Nick Pope, Paul Hamilton, Ryan Wood, Helmut Lammer, Daryl Sims, Richard Boylan, Russell Targ, Remote Viewing, Travis Walton, Jim Sparks.
Mm.
You see, Jim Sparks will be in Hong Kong in a couple of weeks. Well, Paula's been there and done all that, and she's encapsulated the whole story. She knows.
Mm.
But I actually have a great debt to Paula, because I gained my diploma in exopolitics.
Right.
Because Paula was one of my lecturers at Dr. Michael Stahler's Exopolitics Institute.
I see.
So I have a tremendous debt to Paula for everything she's taught me.
Okay.
That's why I've been able to come on all these different shows in Hong Kong and do all these different lectures purely because of this knowledge, you know?
Exactly. And then I'm pretty sure that her informations could be really at the first hand.
Well, you just wait until she starts to tell you about this 1945 UFO crash that happened before Roswell. Now, this is not Paula just telling you something from something she heard. Paula got on a plane with a film crew and went down there.
Right.
And picked up the material she's going to talk to you about.
Yeah, like the wreckage, yes.
Yes, I actually sent you some photographs, which Paula sent.
Yeah.
Where you can see these microchip circuits.
Right.
Layered between the leaves of the metal.
Right.
So I hope you put that up on your website too.
Yeah, I will put it into the forum, and the audience can click into it and register, and then you can see all the photos.
Good, yes.
Okay, as long as I know, this interview with Paula, and I will ask a little bit more about Philip Corso, which is completely, I mean, not related to this crash at 94. 45 at San Antonio. It got nothing to do with that, but I will ask her about Philip Corso a little bit. So can you tell a little bit more story, a background story of who is Philip Corso?
Well, Philip Corso is a military man, and I don't want to say too much because I'll let Paolo expand on it, but he worked for the Foreign Technology Division, Pentagon, and he would basically take any extraterrestrial related artifacts, etc., and hand them over to industry, if you like, to back engineer it. So that's why I think there is a connection between the 1945 crash, at least in principle, so you can see how the role of Philip Corso became important, and how it was important that he developed technology to hand over. I mean, this is basically how the military-industrial complex was born, because Corso and his people were taking this technology and handing it out selectively to various manufacturers. I mean, we got from Roswell, we got things like microchips, we got
some laser device,
all this kind of stuff, fiber optics, and the military industrial complex grew and grew and grew, and they were fortunate, they weaponized most things. So it was very, very important, the job of the Foreign Technology Division with Corso. But there's many, many other sides to Corso, because he knew everything that was going on internally,
right,
in the military with regard to extraterrestrials. So as I say to you, with power that tells you, you can take it to the bank.
Okay. All right. I'm pretty sure the audience can't wait to hear the interview from Paula Harris. Okay. Is there anything else you want to add on before the interview start?
No, I think you'd better hand over to Paula, because it's going to be much more interesting than I'm going to be able to tell you. So
okay.
It's welcome, Paula.
Okay.
Okay. Here we got Paula. Hi, Paula.
Hello.
Hi, Paula. This is Chuck Fei, and we have Neil here as well. How are you?
Very good. It's good to be with you, and Neil is a very good friend. We work together.
That's great. Right. I'm sorry. What time is it there?
It is a little after 6:30 in the evening.
Oh, that's not too bad. Here is 9:30 in the morning. So anyway, thanks for helping, and thanks for the interview here. So you would like to share some of the information of the UFO crash in 1945. Is that right?
Yes. Let me say first that I'm an investigative journalist, which means I work in the way that a professional works. I do investigative journalism. And when I will talk about this crash, it is a story like any news story that I've been working on for the last year. It's taken me 1 year to interview the people,
right,
to go to the place, to check out all the sources. And when I finish doing this story, the 1945 UFO, then we have a little piece of history.
Right.
So the story of this, it's San Antonio, New Mexico, and you people are used to the New Mexico kind of scenario, because Roswell was in New Mexico.
Exactly.
And also the 1945 testing of the atomic bomb was in New Mexico.
That's right.
The testing of the atomic bomb was some 20 minutes away from San Antonio. In fact, the two men who were little boys at the time,
right,
they were two little Hispanic, Spanish speaking little boys.
Right.
It was Jose Padilla, he was 9 years old, and Remy Baca, who was seven, lived right near where the atomic bomb exploded.
I see.
2 months later, on August 15th, they were in their they were in the fields looking for the cows that their father had told them to go and look for. And as they were there, there was a big thunderstorm with thunder and lightning.
Right.
And they witnessed from the sky a UFO that came in. It crashed. A piece broke off, and it left about a half mile of trench.
Right.
That means a long kind of destruction on the ground. They were two little boys, so they were very curious. So they went to see what happened, and they stood about 500 yards from the craft, which was avocado shaped. It was round. Mm. It was not saucer shaped. And a piece had broken off.
Right.
And they could see creatures with long arms, spindly arms, that seemed to be gliding, sliding back and forth. And they heard a high-pitched sound.
Right.
High-pitched. Mm. And they felt that these creatures were injured or hurt because it sounded like they were making this high-pitched sound. They stood there for a little while, then they ran home. Jose told his father, mm-hmm. who called the sheriff. The sheriff called the military.
Right.
And in 3 days, the army, the military came and cleaned it up. They cleaned up the crash and asked Jose's father, could they break down the fence and make a new gate? But they said they were recovering a weather balloon.
Right.
So his father said, why do you have to make such a big gate for a weather balloon? Now the little boys saw the recovery. They saw the men picking up the craft and putting it on a truck. And the truck was parked there. And when the men were not looking, Jose went inside the craft and pulled off a piece of metal. Inside the craft. He saw the inside of the craft. And he pulled off a piece of metal.
Yep.
Sized, with an electron microscope. And it is very interesting. It's a big piece of metal. It was on a panel. On the wall. And the story is incredible because these two men are now 70 years old and they have families and they are okay at 70 years old telling the story and having the metal analyzed. So we know of a crash before Roswell and we have two witnesses who are still alive.
Okay, they're still alive. Right, so this is the basic story.
Right.
Of this crash. So we'd like to go in a little details. Okay. So how far is it? I mean, because for Hong Kong people, not many people have the concept of how far is St. Antonio between St. Antonio to Roswell. How far is that?
It's a 1 hour drive from Roswell.
Is it on the south area or is it on the west side?
Well, on my website, I have a map of where it is. And it's on, the crash happened on 180,000 acres. There's a lot of desert there. And it's desert that does not have homes on it. So Jose Padilla's father owned the farm. He owned the acreage.
Right.
And he raised cows. And they had been there for a long time. For hundreds of years, the Padillas and the Bacas had been part of the San Antonio community. It is Spanish community.
Okay.
So the thing is that this was interesting because the men that cleaned up the crash were not used to cleaning up crashes. They were the same men that were working at the Trinity site for the atomic bomb. It was those soldiers that had to deal with that 2 months later and 2 years before Roswell. So they did not wear the white suits, you know, the contamination, the white hazmat suits. They did not. They just went out there.
Right.
And the problem was they could have been exposed to radiation or anything.
They did not.
Yeah, they did not get prepared because they weren't used to it. It was not something that they had done before. The problem with that area is that they had 3 crashes. Because whoever is visiting, whatever craft or extraterrestrial visitations there were connected with our exploding the atomic bomb and the Earth's entering the atomic age.
Right. Okay. So from your report, I read your report before, and then from the report they said they experienced the atom bomb test, which almost blind their eyes and deaf their ears. So they were that close to the atom bombs area.
Yes, they were, and they were little boys, and Remy tells me his bed went from one side of the room to the other, and they were not told it was a bomb. they were told that it was just explosions, that they were testing missiles and so forth. They were not told that they were testing the bomb. And, they were not prepared for this.
Mm. So they only find out later on?
Well, they found out right after the explosion because the town is so small.
Right.
And in the story, there is a cafe called the Owl Cafe. Mm. And the paperclip scientists, for instance, Oppenheimer,
right,
and those people used to stop at that cafe, and these little boys saw them there. They saw the scientists stopping. It was the only cafe there was close by, and they served food, beer, ice cream, and that is also where the soldiers stopped with the craft on the flatbed, and that is the reason why, the little boy had time to run inside because they left the truck.
Right. Oh, they left the truck, so the boys get in there.
Yeah.
I understand. Because I was thinking...
Left the truck, and so the Remy just jumped aboard and got a crowbar, and pried the handle, this piece of metal, loose. And the piece of metal is very impressive because it's very big.
Mm. At those days, the military is not that serious to block the case, block the news. Is that right? So that's why they can easy to get into the craft when the soldiers went for a coffee break.
Right, exactly. But it was the first one. We think it was the first crash because it was in 1945.
Yeah.
So they did not have any procedure.
I see.
It was not like Roswell.
Mm.
But the thing that's beautiful, and I'm going to say this about Roswell, is that Jesse Marcel Sr. Brought the pieces of the crash home to his family, and he was an intelligence agent. He knew the difference between a weather balloon. He knew it was not a weather balloon. And he let his family see the pieces because he knew it was historical. Mm. So he brought them in the kitchen. He put them on the floor. His son Jesse Marcel Jr., who is a good friend of mine, told me, my father brought these pieces home, 1947. I touched them.
Yeah.
But then my father had to take them back to the military.
Right. And it seems like they are not using any new explanation. After these 2 years, they're still saying this is hot air and a weather balloon.
Yes, we'll see. That's a very good observation. The reason why they're not talking about it is because it would open up a box of lies, a tapestry of lies that would never, ever end. Because when you admit that this was an extraterrestrial craft, and when you admit, as Colonel Corso was brave enough to see, that they were using the pieces to back engineer technology, then you have problems.
Exactly.
So no country is going to go back to the original source, the Roswell crash.
Right.
And the Air Force will continue to say weather balloon because the people want to believe that.
Right. Okay. Do you have any idea, or is anyone giving any explanation why it crashed? If they have such high technology, and what is the reason they crashed?
First of all, if you notice, the crashes happen in New Mexico, which has terrible thunderstorms, terrible lightning. And there is an interaction between the lightning, the very intense radar towers, and Remy Bach and Jose Padilla told me there was a radar tower right there just before the crash, the craft landed and crashed. There was an intense radar tower which interferes with the navigation system of the craft.
I see.
If it interferes with the navigation system, they have no way to, to deal with it. I don't believe it was shot down. I think it was unexpected. And then also you add the lightning storms and you have problems.
Right. So probably the storm hit the craft, and then it caused a crash.
Yes.
Okay. So, tell me about the creatures. Did they have any details? Describe
about
all the creatures.
Yeah, that the creatures had eyes that look like a manta. The Spanish word that used was Kapomosha, which is like a manta kind of eyes. Mm. They said had kind of insect eyes, but they were humanoid. They had one piece kind of suits on, and they had arms and legs.
Right.
So the head was very strange, but they had an outfit that was very close to the body, and they had arms and legs, and they seemed to be sliding, he said, sliding back and forth.
Okay. So did they say anything about the skin color?
They were gray.
Gray.
Yeah, they were gray.
Gray color with the suit. And then just like human with fingers and long legs, long arms.
Yeah, except the eyes, he said, reminded him of a manta, a praying mantis type insect, that kind of eyes. Very, he had the feeling that they knew the two little boys were there because he said he got pictures in his head, which means he stood there and he got some kind of impression.
They're telepathic.
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So they transfer the telepathic and they hear the high-pitched sound.
Yes.
Did they say the high-pitched sound is from the craft itself or from the creatures?
No, the creatures. In fact, Remy, who was only 7, began to cry. He thought the creatures were hurt. He thought they had been hurt. And Jose wanted to go in, but they were too scared. They turned around and ran away. They were on horseback. They were on horses.
Okay. So they were on horses and 200 feet away from the creatures, from the
Yeah, I think it was 500 feet. They weren't... In other words, they weren't really close, but they were close enough to look inside. There was a lot of smoke, they said, and a funny smell, you know. So it had just happened when they walked up. Yeah. The next time they saw the craft, there was nothing in there. Either the creatures had left or somebody had taken them or something.
Mm. So that is the last time they see the creatures. The first time and the last time, right?
Put it this way. Yes. Mm-hmm.
And then after that, they get back there, I think 2 days later, right? And then they don't see the creatures anymore, but the craft is still there. So
the craft is there, yes.
Okay. They believe that the creatures somebody take them away, or do they think they just left?
No, they don't know. They don't know. What's interesting that I will add is when they took the piece, when they took the big piece, and I will have a picture of that on my website.
Right.
I can even send you a picture of the piece that they took off the wall. They hid it in the floor of the little house of the shepherd that was on the Padilla property. They hid the piece in the floorboards. They put the floorboards, the wood on top. And the shepherd did not know that. The man that was taking care of the sheep, and he came over to Jose's house and he said he had had a strange dream. He dreamed some creatures came through the wall and were looking for something. And were looking for something. And because Jose and Remy are Spanish, that piece they took, they called El Tesoro, which means treasure. And in the dream, the shepherd said they were looking for Tesoro. They were looking for Tesoro. They were calling it Tesoro, which stayed under the floorboards for years, that piece. Nobody ever found it.
So obviously that is not a dream, but they actually get into the room and come through the wall and looking for the piece of metal.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, but the metal, Neil showed me the photos before, the pictures of that piece of metal, and it seems like it's not that high technology metal. It's kind of like a rusty metal that can be used in the range.
Yeah.
But that is the piece they get really close to the craft.
That's the piece that they took off from the inside. First of all, I want to say the metal's been analyzed. It's been analyzed at Los Alamos Labs and in England. Mm. And the metal has inside very strange configuration. Mm. It's the same configuration that Colonel Corso talked about. It looks like dead insects, a lot of dead insects. And there's a picture of the inside of the metal by the electron microscope that shows it. And what those things are integrated circuits. They're embedded in the metal. They're integrated circuits that Colonel Corso said he had a piece of metal that it had what looked like dead insects, and what they were integrated circuits. Now, the problem is this. I agree with you. When I held the piece, I saw it. I went there to Remy's house. But you have to take the word or the testimony of the witnesses that they will not lie, and they have no reason to lie, because there's no money around this. There is there is no reason to ruin a family at the age of 70 years old and go public with a lie that has no reason. That's my job. That's why it took 1 year. I had to speak to him. I had to ask him other questions. I had to see if the story panned out. I had to fly to his house and be there and interview him. And you have my 32-page interview.
Right.
And I had to see if I, as a professional, would believe him. And I do. He's not lying.
Okay. So how heavy is the metal? Is that light or is that...
It's
very light.
It looks like
a solid iron and like...
Right. It's light and it looks like a handle. And he has another piece that's been analyzed too, and it's the outside of the craft. And that piece is very interesting. But he tells a story in his interview that he also picked up something that looked like foil, aluminum foil. And he had that. And when he would fold it, it went back to the same shape, which is the same testimony that we have of the people at Roswell and of Jesse Marcel Jr., that foil type, that when you crush it, it goes back to the same shape. Remy had a piece of that too. So, you know, what they did, and this is interesting, is that when the soldiers were cleaning up the metal, they did not take all of it. They threw it in a hole. And so the little boys took some metal and threw it in a hole. And that metal is still in that hole 60 years later.
Even now.
And that is what they will be working on in the future, digging up all that metal.
Oh, yeah. That is very important that we have to get something from that. Okay. You said the other piece, you just mentioned the other piece of metal is from the outside of the craft. And that piece of metal is like an arch set shape, is that right?
Yeah.
So, and that one is also looks like rusty and black. Did they mention anything about the outlook of the craft?
Well, the craft, they said, was round like an avocado, like the fruit, the avocado. And it had a little piece on top that looked like the kind of a cabin of some kind. You know, on the top part. In fact, there is a reconstruction of that I can send you.
Right.
And they said it was gray. It was gray metal. It was regular gray metal. We're not sure. See, it's really difficult to deal with the UFO phenomenon because we don't know where that craft came from. Maybe it did not come from another planet. We have no idea where this craft came from. And all we know is the creatures were different, but we have no idea where it was made, where it came from.
Okay, so you mean it's probably not from another planet? That could be one of the military.
Anything. There are people that are even saying that there were German technology that were so sophisticated you couldn't tell the difference. The problem is the creatures, not the craft. Because maybe there's been advanced creation of craft other places. So we don't know that much. We don't know. What we're doing is collecting the information. My job is just collecting the information.
Right. Okay. So did they give you any details how the military remove and transport the craft? Because it seems like a very big one. And they have to cut off the gate and to remove it. And it says they have to bring in some built equipments and some crane and trucks, and they have to build up some rack on the truck to move it. It seems like a very big one.
It is. It was. I mean, they had to do that to remove it. They asked permission because it was not their land. Mm. It was Jose Padilla's father's land. To come in, and they said, they told him it was a weather balloon.
Mm.
They said they were afraid of, people coming, so they wanted to, make the area secure, and it could not fit through the gate. So they had to use a crane. They put it up on a flatbed truck, Jose said that they put a covering on it, a tarp, so that nobody could see what it was. But he said he went underneath. He was a little boy, so he could go underneath and go inside the craft.
Okay. Did they say anything about what's inside the craft?
He said that it was very plain. It had no seams. He did not see any screws, seams, or anything. It was all smooth inside.
So smooth inside.
It was very smooth inside. He drew a picture, and you should have that picture, of the panel that this piece was on. First, he tried to pull the piece, and he couldn't, so he went to get a bar.
Right.
It's like a crowbar. And he put the bar in, and he pulled it off that way. But there is a picture of the panel that they drew that this was on. Now, the panel was up against the wall.
Right.
So they pulled something that was on the wall off.
Okay, so from the Roswell case, we heard from Jesse Marshall the piece of metal he got with some symbols or some text on it. Did they find any text on this craft or any piece of metal?
I don't know because I didn't ask that question. That's a good question to ask. I didn't ask it. I think that when he went in, though, it was pretty dark. So I don't think necessarily they saw anything like that, but that's a good question.
Okay. So they get into the craft, and then during the coffee break of the soldiers, and then they grab the piece of metal, and then they left.
They left, and they hit it.
They hit it. Okay. They still have it. They still have it, which is the piece of metal they showed you the other day. Did they show you the foil that you cannot fold?
No, that's another story that he told me. He put the foil in a cigar box.
In a cigar box.
It's a metal cigar can. It's a Philip Morris cigar can.
Mm.
And many years later, their water windmill was broken. And in order to fix it, they could not find any way of fixing it. So Remy went and took the piece of a metal and that was like a tin foil.
Right.
And he wrapped wire around it and they fixed this windmill. And it is a funny story because that to fix a windmill with extraterrestrial metal
exactly.
is incredible. But Remy told me that he believes that is what is in the hole that we were talking about where all the other metal got thrown. You know, some of it was too heavy and the soldiers didn't want to carry it. So they threw it in this trench. Because it was one of the first crashes. They were not very careful. And that's so the boys did too. The boys threw some things they found there. The thing is, it's 60 years of erosion in the land and the weather. And they really believe that there is some still left there.
Right. Are you planning to go there and dig?
They're working on it. But if they do it, it has to be filmed. It has to be done by...
Exactly.
It has to be a historical occasion. People have to be there. It has to be filmed. It has to be documented. Anything they take from there has to be given. They've decided to give the metal and the pieces they have to the city of Socorro in the museum so they can put it under glass. They want all that to go there for history, for the students, for young people, because they do not want to make any money. They don't want to sell it because people have offered thousands of dollars to buy it, and they do not want to sell it. They want to give it to the city to keep.
Okay, we're back with Paula Harris on Skype in another side in United States. Paula, welcome back.
Hello.
Okay, so now I'm going to ask another information, I mean more detailed information about the crash. So, so far you only have interview with Remy, but I know you have a phone conversation with Jose in California. Did you compare with the information they given?
Yes, in my interview, I asked Remy all the details, and he has a photographic mind, so he remembers more details than Remy. Mm. They both have the very same story. And when I asked Jose in the interview, right. how did you get in there to take the pieces and how did you do this? He said, we were very sneaky. We were very sneaky children, which means that they were very fast, little boys, because right. you have to understand that their job was to herd cattle and to ride horses and to be on the range. They were used to doing these kinds of things.
Yeah.
They did not understand really the seriousness of what they did.
Mm. Yeah, probably the military, the soldier doesn't realize the serious as well. That's why they went for the coffee break and get a chance for the kids to get into the craft.
That's right. Well, it was the first time it happened, so they didn't think anybody would, you know, the kids could do that. But it was reported to the sheriff's name was Apodaca.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you know, the family was under observation. And the military did go to the house of, you know, Jose Padilla's father and say, did the children take anything? Mm. We think the children may have taken some metal. And then the boys were called in and they said, no, we didn't do anything.
Mm.
And there was no way to prove it because they had hidden the piece.
Mm. Did they threaten them saying not to say this to anybody?
Yes, absolutely. Yep. They told them never to talk about it. Never, never to talk about it.
Okay, but those were soldiers at those days, not MIBs later on.
No, it was the military. It was soldiers. I don't think the MIB phenomenon, or that which we call Men in Black, they didn't organize that. I think until after the Majestic 12 group that was put together by President Truman.
Right.
When Roswell happened, they had a real problem. They had a serious problem. This was trying to cover up something they had just put in the newspaper. So they had to get an organization. And I noticed yours is MJ-13, so you should go FJ-12.
Yeah, that is like because MJ-12. I want to step one more step ahead and to disclose things. That is okay. My plan.
Well, I think when Roswell happened in 47, President Truman and the group, the military group that was in charge of this, and I'm sure the people at the Trinity site, the atomic bomb site, also were worried. They had many, many sightings. They were reporting sightings of UFOs during the testing. I think that that's when they started to do the cover-up, what you would call the cover-up. And the cover-up then, years later, had the MIBs, the Men in Black.
Okay. So Remy have a few pieces of metal, and some of them they show you, some of them he used to fix the windmill. And did Jose have any piece of metal with him?
Well, it was both of their metal. And what happened was that the metal was on Jose's property, and Jose goes back to New Mexico. He lives in California.
Right.
But he goes back to New Mexico because his son lives on the property. So after they found each other, and it took years to find each other because one's in Washington State, the other one's in California.
Yes.
They told each other the story. They said, do you remember what happened? They said, yes. And so Jose went back and he took the piece that they had buried and he, believe it or not, FedExed it, Federal Express, to Remy. And he said, you keep it. I can't believe this. It's amazing that he would send it in the mail. But okay. When people do not know what it is and people do not understand what's happening, you can do a lot of things.
Yeah, it's just like a piece of metal from an old machine.
Right.
And it is light and cheap for shipping.
Right.
So definitely they use this way instead of bringing it there themselves. But okay, so Jose have a clear memory because of what do you call it?
He has a photographic memory. He remembers details.
Okay, he remembered the details, and he is the one who get into the craft. So as I know that Jose left San Antonio at the same year, and Remy left in a year later. Did they say any reason why they left? It got nothing to do with the threat, or because they have another chance to move out of town and work somewhere else?
Well, basically, they were boys. They were in high school.
Right.
And their family, and they were poor, poor, poor families. They couldn't survive there. So what happened was that they went to another state, Washington State, Tacoma, Washington, where the father, you know, the family could get a better job, and Remy could go to a better school. And Remy ended up in a much better school, in a much better situation, and he worked for many years in Washington state government with the governor. Mm. He helped get her elected. So this is a man that has worked in politics. Mm. And that helped me a lot as a journalist, because I knew that he must have spoken to somebody about this, otherwise we couldn't do this story.
Right.
Because if this was top secret, I would not be sitting here right now.
Exactly. So who passed you the story?
What happened was that I was in contact with a man in Florida whose father was one of the pilots that flew the crash pieces out of San Antonio. Mm-hmm. And this man had sent me all the documents of his father.
Right.
And what happened was that he named Remy Baca as a source. So yeah. I contacted Remy and I said, did this crash really happen? And he said, yes. And we talked for 1 year. He gave me the details. I thought they were amazing. And I could not even do anything about the story until I met him. And I met him this summer on the 4th of July. I went to the Washington State and spent 2 days with him, saw him, the medal, talked to his wife. And the interesting part, and I'm going to tell you this, is that his wife did not believe in UFOs and did not want Remy to speak until they themselves had had a sighting around, I think it's 1994, a big craft, and that was saucer-shaped, over their house that they saw for 20 minutes at night. And when his wife saw that, and she was totally shaken by this big craft over their house, that's when she said to her husband, you can, you know, go ahead and talk. Because she was Catholic and she did not believe in any of this.
Right. Okay, I wish my wife had the same experience so she can say, Chuck Faye, go ahead and talk. Because she's pretty much doing the same thing right now and telling me not to talk that much. Anyway.
But can I say something, though?
Yeah,
because
go ahead.
This is very important. I had just written a book called Exopolitics, Gateway to a New Reality. Mm. And these sightings and this problem is the family's problem. It's the families that do not want to be embarrassed, that do not want the news people to come to them. And it is a problem with the husband if the wife does not want to be involved. And you can lose your marriage, you can lose your family. Mm. So I think that's very serious that we address this. Thank you to the wives of both Remy Baca and Jose Padilla for their saying yes.
Right. So they can share the information and then we know such a case exists.
Right.
Right. Okay. So we come up to this for the crash so far. But I personally have some questions. I know you are close friend with Philip Corso. And I read his book because I have a little problem with reading. What do you call it, Neil? What is that?
ADHD.
No, not that one. Dyslexia. Yes, I have a little problem with that. So it took me like almost 2 years to finish his book the day after Roswell. So in the books, I heard from rumors that the books, the publisher changed some information of the books from Corso's writing. Like something like how many fingers of the grays did Philip Corso say anything details of the aliens, the grays, with you?
Can I talk about the Philip Corso in family too. The reason why Philip Corso wrote that book was for his three grandchildren, because his three little boys, they were three little boys, his grandchildren said, "Grandpa, did you ever see E.T.? Did you ever see an extraterrestrial?" And then he felt the obligation to talk about this. Now, Philip Corso had notes. He did not write the book. Who wrote the book was Bill Burns. You must have heard of him because he's on television all the time with alien hunters and so forth. So Bill Burns took Philip Corso's notes and he put the, you know, discrepancy in there. There were mistakes in there, but they were not from Philip Corso's notes. They were from Bill Burns having written the book with Corso. Now, there is a problem there in that there's a lot of interesting things. Corso was not at Roswell, but Corso in 1947 saw some bodies go across the the United States when he was stationed at Fort Riley, Kansas. We're not sure what bodies Corso saw. Whatever fingers Corso saw, and I think he said they had four fingers, may not have been those beings that were at Roswell, because there was another UFO crash at Corona,
right,
at the plains of St. Augustine at the same time, the same summer. So Corso saw the bodies. He understood what was he was looking at, but he didn't do anything about it. Roswell has nothing to do with the actual Corso story about his being there, except that in 1960s, he got the artifacts from Roswell. General Trudeau walked into his office with these pieces that he thought one of them was looked like a pen. It looked like, you were just saying about the metal looking like a regular piece of metal. This thing looked like a pen, except that Colonel Corso said, like a stupid human being, he thought the battery was dead. And so he took it to Fort Belvoir, Maryland. He even names where he took it. And he had them put long low waves on it, and a laser came out of it. So the thing is that he had these artifacts that that he was asked to look at them and see if the Army,
right,
not the Air Force and the Navy, the Army could back engineer them or use them for some purposes. And so he, in the book, and I've heard this just from my research, that books, the real story does not come out unless there are some mistakes there. And it's done on purpose so that the people that want to debunk it, what we call debunk, which means completely cancel the story out, find one or two mistakes and they cancel it all out. Nobody thinks about it anymore. And the truth does not come out.
Okay. So you think, what's his name again?
Bill Burns.
So he's one of the cover-up system, is that right?
Well, I don't want to say Bill Burns is... Bill Burns, I don't think, you know, I don't think he knows what's going on. I just know he made a few mistakes in the book. And that did not help Colonel Corso, those mistakes. They did not help him. And Colonel Corso only lived for 2 years after that book was published. It was 1997, and he caused a major stir worldwide with the book. And there was a court case against the book, which made Corso not speak in the United States. And the only reason that I know this is because we brought him to Italy, where I was working, twice.
Yeah.
We flew him to Italy, and he told us much. And he showed us the autopsy of, he showed us notes of the autopsy of the bodies. He showed us notes of the propulsion system. He showed us notes that could never be released in the United States. So we have a problem here in the United States with getting real information, because the cover-up is the worst here. Because maybe because of the back engineering, because of the artifacts, because whatever they have made from not just the Roswell crash. Now remember, now Colonel Corso got this in 1960. This happened in 1947. There was only the Army that time, but it broke off into the Army Air Force in 1948. Do you think maybe the Air Force has a few pieces? They didn't talk about it because they didn't have a Colonel Corso, but maybe they started doing the back engineering as early as 1950.
Right.
So maybe, but that's the Air Force. They're not going to talk to the Army. That's a possibility. That is a good possibility.
I see. So will you be able to share with the autopsy report of the alien later on?
Well, you know, he told me how they were made. He said the lymphatic system was amazing, was different. He said the being had a four-lobed brain. The brain was four lobes instead of two. He said that there was a microchip in one eye and a microchip in one side of the brain, and that it did not have any genital organs. So he called them little clones, or little he called extraterrestrial biological entities. And the thing that Colonel Corso said, which is really interesting, is he said they were created in a laboratory. And who has really created them, he believes, are people like us. He believes their creators were human-type people that created these beings to fly into space. In other words, these were the beings that could fly the ship. Because Colonel Corso then added, in Italy, he said, there is no one that can travel in outer space and not be, physically the way we are. We can't not travel. So we'd have to create something
to be the driver.
Right, exactly. And that's exactly what he said. And that makes sense.
That's right. Okay, as we know that Philip Corso is going to write the second book. I don't know, that is a rumor from Hong Kong. He's going to write the second book before he passed away. So is that true, he's preparing the second book, or is that being hiding somewhere with maybe from the publisher or something?
No, well, his first book was published by Simon & Schuster, and it was Bill Burns who wrote it. He was very upset, Colonel Corso, with the inaccuracy. So what he wanted to do is publish his real notes. His real notes, they were handwritten notes.
Right.
So in Italy, we took the real notes and we published the book. It's called Dawn of a New Age. About 4 months ago, Philip Corso's son, now remember, Philip Corso is dead.
Right.
He died in 1998. Philip Corso's son sold the rights to Dawn of a New Age to Open Minds TV. Now, there's a problem there in that you can go there and read his real notes. I mean, there's some, 123 pages of notes, but you cannot download them, you cannot print them, and you will not have a book. And it's very difficult when we start putting things online like that, because not too many people are going to stay on the screen and read 123 pages. They would rather read a book. So, but that is what the agreement was with the Corso estate, that Open Minds TV, and you can click on it and read his notes. It's called Dawn of a New Age. And it also talks about time travel. So you'll be really interested in that, because Colonel Corso was saying he feels that that ship was a time traveler. It came out of the future. Well, but that'll make you think, will it not?
Yes, definitely. Because we are thinking that it's probably the ship from outer space.
That's right. So if this ship is coming from the future, then why would it go to New Mexico, where we have just invented the atomic bomb? Why? To tell those people that invented the bomb why? Why would it go there? So it's very interesting. It makes people think.
Yeah. So if that is the case, then the grace is probably, probably is generated by us.
Right.
To deal with the time travel issues.
Exactly. It gets complicated, doesn't it?
It is.
This is what's so bad about all of this area, because I was not ready for this. I tell you, my mind could not go to time travel. I mean, I wanted things to be clear and right there so I could see them. And when I realized that I have done several stories about time travel now, that, you know, it's a possibility that they were coming back to warn us about maybe our destroying the planet and the Earth, it got very complicated for me.
Right. Okay. So that's a lot of information. And we will talk to you again very soon in the near future. Neil, you want anything to add in?
I'd just like to know quickly a little bit about your new book. before we close off, and about your courses at the Exopolitics Institute.
Okay, for me, I do very good field research, and my courses at the Exopolitics Institute is around all the interviews I've done. And so what people do is read the interviews and then tell me, write an essay about what they think. And so for me, education is important. Ignorance does not work. If you want to know, you must read, you must study what people have said. And it is history that's important, the history of this phenomenon. And my new book is called Exopolitics, Gateway to a New Reality. And it deals with, it has interviews there by Paul Hellyer, ex-defense minister of Canada, Apollo astronaut Edgar Mitchell, Apollo 14 astronaut. It has an interview with a pilot in 1957 that was asked to shoot down a UFO, Milton Torres, in 1957 in England. So, you know, I have these real military interviews that will help everyone understand that UFOs are real.
I have no doubt about it. And I'm pretty sure Neil has no doubt about UFO is real, right?
Correct.
Okay. Right. Okay, Paula, thank you very much for the interview and thank you for your time. And I wish you a very happy Thanksgiving.
Okay, we're back to MJ13. And you just finished with Paula Harris' interview. Now, is there anything else you want to add? You want to add in any more information?
Well, as I warned you, it was going to be explosive, controversial, and Paula certainly did the job.
Yeah.
So I think it was a very, very good interview, don't you?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Yeah, at least this is
breaking news. It's first-hand news. Exactly. Nobody's heard it. Exactly. Nobody would even have access to it. So there you go.
Yeah. And this is
exopolitics for you. This is really exopolitics. The study, the social and political implications. You know, we're studying the key actors. We're studying the institutions. And whistleblower testimony, and here it is.
Right. This is amazing. Well, thank you very much for Exopolitics to bring in Paula Harris. As this is big news, this is really mind blowing that we actually have crash before Roswell. I mean, Roswell is a famous case, but the crash before that, 2 years before that, and that is nobody really heard about it. Nobody really know this is such a case. Anyway. Now, thank you very much, but I knew you got a new book coming up.
Yeah, well, it's actually out. It's published. You can get it at Amazon.com.
Right.
And it's called Close Encounters of the ADHD Kind.
Right.
Which is a gentle introduction into the UFO phenomenon.
Right.
But it also uses the fact that ADHD, in some cases, not all cases, involves a gene that makes us resistant. I mean, that's why most of us are naughty, because we're resistant to authority. And this is very important, because it out of this comes tremendous quality in people. I mean, all the greatest people you could ever imagine, Einstein, you name them.
They were all genius. Yes.
They changed the world.
Right.
They're resistant to anybody telling them not to, you know, to keep still or stop polluting society with nonsense. No, they don't. They continue. They change things. And that's what this book is about. It's actually about a real life case. So many, many parents have kids who are ADHD.
Right.
In some cases, not all cases, there's nothing wrong with them. They're just simply highly intelligent, but extremely bored.
Right.
So in order to satisfy the boredom, you know, they become hyperactive.
Right.
And in some cases, they've had contact. It is a symptom. It mimics the ADHD symptom. Contact.
So it is a symptom itself, it's not a sickness.
I don't believe that most of the ADHD that I'm talking about is a sickness. I think it's a symptom of advanced consciousness. But of course, there are those people who have something pathologically wrong with them. Of course, they have a comorbidity, they have something wrong behind all that.
Right.
So I don't want anybody to think for 1 minute that just because your child is showing symptoms of ADHD that they're a star child. No, but in many cases they are. And unfortunately, they're being drugged and ignored.
Yeah, that is important. So, I will put up the links. I will put up the links into the forum, including the photos that Paula Harris provided. and about the cases of this crash in 1945. Correct. I keep on saying the wrong days. Why?
ADHD.
Anyway, yeah, we put up the pictures and also the link of Neil's new books, and you can register in the forum, and then you can get up there and see the pictures and all that. Okay, Neil, thank you very much for Exopolitics bringing in Paula Harris, and who's gonna be the next guest?
Well, I think we have a huge pool of international guests, which will be brought exclusively to MJ13. And I think the best thing to do is let the people stay tuned, let the people keep coming back looking at the MJ13 site.
Right.
And we'll let on in due course who the next guest will be. And I can assure you, it'll be very interesting.
Yeah, I'm sure when you stay tuned to MJ13, you won't be disappointed.
Absolutely correct. I hope we see a lot of the people at the Sparks event.
Oh, yeah. Jim Sparks will be in a few weeks.
Yes.
Yeah. And
what to that?
No, I'm pretty sure the ticketing is quite good now. As far as I know, a lot of people who is not related to this alien stuff and UFO stuff, they're not the guests of NJ13, but they're just friends of mine. They all listen, and they all knew about this lecture, and they brought the tickets
to Jim Sparks. Yeah, well, of course, yes. Because the case is famous. I mean, it's one of the unique abduction cases where Jim Sparks has total memory recall of the whole event, being abducted by these aliens and being educated for 19 years by them on the spacecraft.
Yeah,
so he has a message for humanity.
People
at least come and listen, keep an open mind, but listen.
Yeah, and they didn't erase his memory because the reason they want him to talk.
They want him to talk, and you know, it's all about really the motivations, if you like, because all extraterrestrials have an agenda,
right?
And I think the motivation for these extraterrestrials was to give an amnesty to all those Americans in the military, or let's say the black operations within the military. In other words, the operations outside of government oversight,
right?
So the black project secret,
right?
And these covert groups all hold incredible technology. They could free us all as human beings, free energy, fix the planet, fix the pollution. So I think those people are all afraid to come out because they'll go to jail.
Yeah.
So what Sparks and what the extraterrestrials told Sparks basically is to, you know, try and get some laws changed, and let's have an amnesty, get these people out. Let's move on with our evolution.
Right. So if you're listening to this and you want to go on for the lecture, you can get all the details information from Facebook. When you get on Facebook, you can just type in and search Jim Sparks in Hong Kong, and you got all the information when it will start and where you can get the ticket, all kind of information you can get from the Facebook page. Is that right?
Absolutely correct. And the tickets are at CityLine.
Yeah.
So it's all online, it's easy.
That's right. Okay, thank you a lot. Thanks a lot, Neil. And you can't wait for the next time to bring in more expert and more mind-blowing cases. Okay, you're listening to MJ13. This is Chuck Fay. Thank you very much, and we'll see you next week. Bye.
Goodbye.